Good morning, everybody. We are ready to begin our study of the book of Judges this morning. So we're just going to head right into that, having finished Joshua on Thursday. And I've prepared an outline for this. Over the weekend, we've run out of toner. That's being replaced, so we don't have any hard copies. If you would like to look at the outline, I invite you to go over to our website, 14avcoc.org, click on Online Resources and Bible Class Handouts, and you'll see a folder in there for the Book of Judges. Any handouts that I generate for this class will go in that folder, and right now there is an outline for the Book of Judges. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time focused on introductory stuff this morning, mainly because some of the thematic stuff is going to come out pretty clearly in the text itself. The author of Judges is going to tell us in the first section of the reading exactly what's going on in Israel's history at this point in time, and kind of what the strategy is for this book, right? Where this history of Israel is going. And I say the author of Judges because the book itself does not tell us who authored it. Right? The traditional identification is Samuel, but again, we don't know that for certain one way or the other. It's not something that we get from the Bible. It's something that we get from tradition, generally from rabbinic tradition. So I will probably just refer to whoever wrote it as the author of Judges instead of plugging an amen. The first section that we're going to deal with in the book of Judges is the first two chapters and a little bit of chapter 3. So if we start in chapter 1, verse 1, and through chapter 3, verse 6, that kind of sets the introduction for this whole set of stories. And it's going to deal with what we commonly call the Canaanization of Israel. And you'll see in the first chapter what we mean by that, that Israel is essentially becoming Canaanite in the way that they conduct themselves. And it's going to show us the rise of the judges, why there need to be judges over Israel. And again, it's going to show us a lot of the themes that we're going to deal with in the book of Judges. So let's go ahead and jump right into the text this morning. Chapter 1, verse 1. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." And Judah said to Simeon his brother, "Come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory allotted to you." So Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. And they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. They found Adoni-Bezek at Bezek, and fought against him, and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni-Bezek fled, but they pursued him, and caught him, and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And Adoni-Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. And the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who lived in the hill country, in the Negev, and in the lowland. And Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba. And they defeated Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "He who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will give him Aksa, my daughter, for a wife." So Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it. And he gave him Aksa, his daughter, for a wife. When she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" And she said to him, "Give me a blessing, "Since you have set me in the land of the Negev, give me also springs of water." And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. And the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of Palms into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev near Arad. And they went and settled with the people. And Judah went with Simeon his brother, and they defeated the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and devoted it to destruction. So the name of that city was called Hormah. Judah also captured Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. And the Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain, because they had chariots of iron. And Hebron was given to Caleb, as Moses had said. And he drove out from it the three sons of Anak. All right, this part of the book, and actually before we continue, can we close the front door? It is still open. My apologies for interrupting. This section of the book hinges on the death of Joshua. All right, we're going to receive two notices about this in the first couple of chapters. We've already read in chapter 1, verse 1, after the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquire to the Lord. We're going to get another notice of his death, again in chapter 2. So all of the events in these opening chapters hinge on Joshua's death. And so that's going to invite some questions for us about Israel. All right, how is Israel going to fare without Joshua? And who's going to take Joshua's place? The book is going to use Joshua's death not just as a chronological marker, like this is when the story is happening. It does that at the very beginning, right? All of this stuff is happening right after the death of Joshua. But it's also going to use it as a theological marker, right? So this is what happens to the spiritual state of Israel and their covenant relationship with God once Joshua is gone. And in general, we should note that this part of the book is not super concerned with chronology. All right, we're going to begin to see that, again, with the second death notice in chapter 2, where we're going to wonder, wait a minute, what all has happened first? Is Joshua dead? Is he not dead for this part of the story? In fact, some of the events that we've just read about here in the first chapter are things that we already read in the book of Joshua. Right? So the text tells us, first off, after the death of Joshua, all of this stuff is going on. But then we get these stories about, for example, the conquest of Hebron and Debir. That's stuff that we read about in the book of Joshua while Joshua was still alive. Particularly this story about Caleb going and conquering them. And remember, Caleb is the one who gets the city of Hebron as his inheritance. And he goes up to conquer Debir, and he offers Aksa, his daughter, as a wife to whoever conquers it. And Othniel goes in and conquers it and receives Aksa as his prize. All right, all of this is stuff that we know from Joshua happened while Joshua was alive. All right, so that cues us in that the book of Judges, again, is not so concerned. It's not arranged chronologically, right, in the way that we would think in modern times a history ought to be arranged. It is arranged more topically and thematically. Right? This is all stuff that centers around the death of Joshua. And we're going to see Israel change as a result of Joshua's death. Now, the book begins with some promise. Right? So this text that we just read in chapter 1 starts with some promise. What's the very first thing the sons of Israel do after Joshua dies in verse 1? They inquire of the Lord, which is almost always a good sign for Israel. Right, there's a lot of times that they get themselves in trouble for not inquiring of the Lord first. It's a good sign that they inquire of the Lord. And their inquiry itself also is a good sign. Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? So they still, at this point, seem resolved to do what we know they're supposed to do. All right, that was one of the big things we talked about in Joshua, that there's still a lot of conquering, a lot of, you know, dispossessing the nations so that they can take full possession of their inheritance. There's still a lot of that left to do at the end of the book of Joshua. And here we see Israel seemingly committed to that as they're asking the Lord about it. Who's going to go up first for us? All right, so Judah and Simeon go up. They drive out the Canaanites and the Perizzites from their territory. So they actually follow through on this. That's another good sign. And Judah and Simeon are cooperating together in doing this, which is, again, another good sign for Israel. Israel continues to be unified, which was one of the questions of the book of Joshua. Is Israel going to continue to be unified? But then we see a little crack in this once we get to verse 19. All right, even this verse starts out promising, but it ends up, again, showing us some cracks. And the Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but, this is where things start to fall apart, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. This is the beginning of what's going to turn into a long pattern of failure in Israel. This is, by the way, an excuse that we have heard before in the book of Joshua. You'll remember the sons of Joseph come to Joshua and they complain that their territory is not great enough. And one of the problems is that the pagans that live among them have chariots of iron, and they can't drive these guys out of the plains. When we had already seen Joshua with his armies defeat armies with chariots. Right? So Israel knows that it can be done. It's just that it's kind of like facing down a tank, right? Just because you've seen somebody on foot, you know, shove a grenade into a tank or something, doesn't mean that you necessarily want to be the one, you know, climbing up those treads. People aren't exactly eager to face these things down. So the sons of Joseph, again, were complaining about it, and here we find that Judah just fails to do it. They do not take full possession of the plain because the inhabitants there have chariots. In the middle of all of this, we get an odd little story that I want us to pay special attention to because it's something that's very typical for the author of Judges. Judges is going to tell us a story about Israel's moral state where some of the pertinent details are not going to be in neon lights, at least starting out. The author of Judges subtle's maybe not the right word for it. This is some really good storytelling, the way that the author of Judges brings things across to us. Because we're going to start with some, what we might call some foreshadowing, things that are not explicit and overt. And in fact, we'll notice as we read along, once we get to the actual judges themselves, we'll get these notices at the beginning of each section. Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord and worshipped after the Baals and so on. And so the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for X number of years. We're going to get those little notices at the beginning of each section. There's going to be a lot of stuff that happens in the middle of those stories, though, where the author of Judges does not give us any kind of moral comment at all. And it leaves us to our own devices for a while. And once we get to the conclusion of the book, we'll see why that is. Because a lot of this stuff is going to build up to the conclusion of the story. The odd little detail, the odd bit of the story in this text, is the story of Adonai Bezek. And that name, by the way, Adonai Bezek, just means Lord of Bezek. All right, so pretty typical Hebrew repetitiveness in verse 5. They found the Lord of Bezek at Bezek. right? Like, where else would we expect to find the Lord of Bezek? That's just the way they tell their stories. So they found the Lord of Bezek at Bezek. They fought against him and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. All right, so far, we have a normal story. Adonai Bezek fled, the Lord of Bezek fled, but they pursued him and caught him. Okay, normal so far. And cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Now, wait a second. Now, the author of Judges himself provides no comment on this. He has Adonai Bezek comment on this. Before we get to Adonai Bezek's explanation for what he thinks is going on, we need to ask, or wait a second, do we have any precedent for Israel, for Judah doing what they're doing to the Lord of Bezek, cutting off his thumbs and his big toes? Up to this point in the Bible, have we seen Israel do anything similar to that? Yeah, so later David is going to he's going to kill a bunch of Philistines, and it's essentially like scalping, right? Where you're taking it as a war trophy to show, hey, I killed this guy. Yes, he did this to other people. Right, yeah. So Adonai Bezek frames this as his own sin coming back on his own head. As far as the law and the writings are concerned, what we've read up to this point, do we have any precedent for the sons of Judah taking this kind of action?
No, but sort of, because...
Okay, good. All right, there we go. That's probably the best justification that we could give to this, is eye for eye and tooth for tooth. That invites a question, because that's a matter of justice, all right? That's one of the standards of justice for violent crimes in the law of Moses, is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And so that invites the question, is the book of Judges going to be about how just Israel is? Now, that's a question we need to hold on to, because we're right at the beginning of the story. Do we think this is an example of Judah just executing justice? The only other thing that even comes close would be what Levi and Simeon did to the city of Shechem. And even then, That's not super close. I mean, they tell all of the men of Shechem to get circumcised, and then they go in while these guys are sore, and they murder all of them. And you remember Jacob's reaction to that. Jacob was none too pleased with that, because Shechem had, you know, come and offered the bride price for Dinah. And as a result, Levi and Simeon, you know, get cut out of the primary part of their inheritance, at least as far as Jacob is concerned. All right, Rena, I saw your hand first.
Well, I just wanted to add a comment that in the Bible, they really say we don't have the right to have revenge, you know? We don't have the right for justice. It's God.
Right. Yeah, so now this is not a vengeance story. You know, Judah's not taking revenge on Adonai Bezek for something that Adonai Bezek did to Judah. In fact, the way that it's presented to us, I mean, it's just flatly laid out there. They caught him and they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Did they know that he commonly cut off other people's thumbs and big toes? We don't know. The text doesn't tell us, right? We'd be working from silence on that. We're just confronted with this sudden fact that, wait a minute, they just cut this guy's thumbs and his big toes off. Hey, Solomon, go ahead.
I was just going to point out the parallel that clearly is here between Jesus' parable.
Yes. In fact, there's something we need to do with that. Before we get to that, we're going to hold on to that for just a second. There's, you know, the only clear answer as far as precedent goes, right? Who's the only other person in the Bible up to this point that we have seen cutting off people's thumbs and big toes other than Judah? It's Adonai Bezek himself. It's this guy. He's the only other person that we've seen cutting off thumbs and big toes so far. And how does he understand what has happened? He understands this as a reversal of fortune, and he understands it to be his comeuppance for his own cruelty. All right, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. This gives you some idea, by the way, of why someone in the ancient world would cut off their enemy's thumbs and their big toes. Devana? That they did or did not know?
That they did.
That they did know? Okay. What infers that to us?
The fact that he said not to look anywhere else, and that the fact that they knew that it was known. It's inferred that it was known.
I think that might be a little, that might be taken too much out of the text. It's, at this point, it's kind of an open question whether they know or not.
Why would they go for it? I get her point. I know what you're saying.
Yeah. No,
why the thumbs and toes without, you know,
right.
Without direction. They didn't get clear direction from the Lord, Scripture tells us here.
Uh-huh.
But why could you go get the thumbs?
Right.
And even, I think Adam, was that, says, so God repaying me.
Yes.
So it's almost like he expected this punishment.
Looking back, he realizes, all right, this is what I had coming to me. Well, again, that is kind of the question. And what I want to get at with this is that the author of Judges leaves some things like this ambiguous to us because of where the story is going to go later on. All right, so at this point in the story, depending on how sympathetic we are to Judah, our natural, like our gut instinct could be to say, well, yeah, they had to have known. Or they have to be justified in doing this because, I mean, this is God's people we're talking about. This is the tribe of Judah. Of course they have to be justified.
Where on the map would they have been? Where would their territory have been compared to Judah?
We're talking, where was Bezek? I want to say that it's up in the northern part of Judah. We're talking generally about this region, though. Again, at this point of the story, it kind of depends on where our gut wants to take us with it. By the end of the book of Judges, it is going to be left completely clear, like unequivocal, what Israel's moral state is. And here we are getting, I think foreshadowing is probably the best word for it. Because it may be that Judah had some good reason, some moral justification for what they're doing here. It very well may be. Where this is going to lead in Israel's story is somewhere very, very not good. But let's come back to this question, though. Why does somebody, not just talking Judah in specific, but just anyone in general, why would somebody cut off someone's thumbs and big toes? Adonai Bezek gives us a glimpse into that, why someone would cut off their thumbs and their big toes. These 70 kings that he has done it to, why does he keep these guys around? What's their job in the king's court? Yeah, they eat scraps under the table. Right? These are essentially living war trophies. Wayne?
Well, thanks for the question. You use your big toes for balance.
Yeah.
You use your thighs for grasping.
Yes.
It makes you incapacitated.
Yes.
Because you can't pick up things. You can't walk.
Yes.
So it just puts you in a position to where you've got to do whatever anybody wants you to do, and if that's cleaning up the scraps on the table, then that's your job. That's what you do. Because
it makes you completely helpless. And you look at the way that these guys have to act for Adonai Bezek. He's turned them into dogs, is what he's done.
Do you get the impression that he's entertained by this?
I mean, why else do you keep these 70 guys around?
It's almost like, look what I did.
Yeah.
Here's what I can do to you.
It's absolutely a trophy like that. It is a display of power. I beat these guys. They are so under my thumb that they don't even have thumbs anymore. Now, Oh, go ahead, Rena.
I just wanted to, something just popped in my head is that in all the conquests, you know, the Lord may have commanded, you know, the people to devote to destruction, but he never commanded them to do stuff like that.
That, I think, is important to note because what the law commands for all of the kings and the peoples who inhabit the promised land is that they be devoted to destruction. We've seen Joshua do it, right? When he had the campaign of the five kings, and he hunts these five kings down to the cave of Machpelah, and he yanks them out of the cave, what's he do to them? Does he chop off their feet and make them crawl around in his train? No, he just beheads them. Right, he just straight up kills him, which is what he's told to do.
In a way, that's more merciful than torture.
In an ancient context especially, yeah, it's absolutely more merciful. And it's exactly what Joshua was commanded to do, to devote these people to destruction. Here, Judah does not kill Adonai Bezek. They keep him alive. And we're not even told explicitly how he dies, but that they brought him along with them to Jerusalem. Not because they live in Jerusalem, but because they're going to conquer Jerusalem. All right, so again, what's it look like whenever Judah is going out to conquer a city and they bring along with them a king whose thumbs and toes they have cut off? Right, it says that he died there. We don't know what of, right? Could have been, I mean, they could have killed him. Could have been old age, could have choked on a grape. Hey, we just don't know. But they bring him along with to Jerusalem. At this point, again, the author of Judges has not given us anything explicit, but if we spend more than 2 seconds with it, it does not look good. There's a reason why I'm kind of belaboring this point. Because this is something that we need to carry with us through the book. Because a lot of the book's point about Israel's faithlessness, especially later on, centers around Israel's refusal to treat people the way that the law requires. Israel itself is going to treat people in subhuman ways. And it's going to get real bad before the end of this book. I'm just going to warn you. It's going to get really bad. And here we get our first hint of it. Again, the author does not come out and explicitly say they broke faith in doing this, they did evil in the sight of the Lord. But we've been given all of the equipment to at least raise our eyebrows at this and say, wait a second, the only other guy who ever did this, the thumbs and the big toes thing in Scripture, we see why he did it, and we see what he thinks came of it, right? Because I did this stuff, as I have done, so God has repaid me. And we have to ask ourselves, do we think Adonai Bezek is right or wrong? If he's right, then we have to wonder, well, has Judah also invited that on themselves? If he's wrong, and God is not repaying him for what he's done, then again, we have to ask what justification Judah has for doing what they've done. Right, the author of Judges puts us into a sticky spot with that. So, but again, it's just presented as like a little, it's just a little story. Guys cutting off people's thumbs into big toes. Beth? Absolutely. Yes.
And this is the first place we're seeing this again. And to say that God is a big thing, I think in some ways, yes. But that's not how God's justice works. It's not justice in the way of
eternity.
Yes. You might lose your life, you could have been disobeyed and not done that, but it's usually not
when you're drawn out. Right. Yeah, we don't find a place in the law where Israel is told, oh yeah, if somebody commits this sin, humiliate them by mutilating them. We do not find that. So, and that is an absolutely essential point to carry forward with us, is that ultimately, right, what makes Judah, what distinguishes Judah at this point from Adoni-Bezek? Well, it's that Adoni-Bezek had 69 more people that he did this to. But that's really the only essential difference at this point. And it's going to be like, I mean, by the end of the book of Judges, it's going to be like the end of Animal Farm. Y'all ever read Animal Farm? You know how by the end of the story, you know, the pigs that have kind of taken control of the farm, they end up negotiating with these human businessmen, and it's behind closed doors, and at the end they come out, and they're all walking on their hind legs, and the rest of the farm animals have a hard time telling the difference between the pigs and the people. That's exactly the way this book is going to go. What Beth said is exactly true. You're going to have a hard time distinguishing between Israel and Canaan, which is why we call this very first section of Judges the Canaanization of Israel. We are watching the process of them becoming Canaanite. Wayne, I saw your hand.
Well, that's what I was going to say. This is akin to, we're told to, and this happens a lot in our world, when we make war, instead of destroying people, we go in and capture them. We put them in prison. And over time, you get to know them and become our friends, and we have mercy on them. They, you know, go to bars with us and everything, and the first thing you know, we're just the same thing they are. And over time, like you said, we get Canaanized ourselves.
Yeah.
This is a lot of what happens in our world, and it's a lot of what happens right here.
Yeah, a big part of the book's warning is against our own canonization.
Yeah.
So, good.
Do you find it strange that the Canaanite king says, so God has repaid you? He doesn't say, so your God has repaid you. He says, so God has repaid you.
That is interesting. It is interesting.
That phrase, he didn't say your God.
Yeah.
He said, so God. Almost like he's believing that the Israelites are God.
Yeah, it's another one of these little ambiguous things. You could interpret it that way, or you could interpret it, and the way that it would be written in Hebrew, he could just be saying, so the gods have repaid me. But it is going to be one of the key questions of the book, is watching how Israel understands God, compared especially to the pagan gods of the peoples around them. We're going to see a lot of confusion having to do with that. So let's continue verse 21, and we're going to read through the rest of the chapter. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. The house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. And the house of Joseph scouted out Bethel. Now the name of the city was formerly Luz. And the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, please show us the way into the city, and we will deal kindly with you. And he showed them the way into the city. And they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites and built a city and called its name Luz. That is its name to this day. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. When Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. And Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, so the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol, so the Canaanites lived among them but became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or of Ahlab, or of Zeb, or Helba, or Afik, or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth-Anat, so they lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh and of Beth-Anat became subject to forced labor for them. The Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres, in Aijalon, in Shalbim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor. And the border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Silah and upward. All right, so the remainder of the chapter presents Israel's failure as progressively getting worse and worse. Wayne?
Okay. So much you picked up on. Okay. And it's a 20-book, but I just want to point out. First, eight, in the marriage of polygastration, captured and discovered the edge of the sword and set the city on fire.
Right.
Then, 21, but the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem, so the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. That's a total contradiction, almost.
It just means that there's a lot of details between those two things that we're not privy to. There's a lot of ways to explain how this works out. The end result of it, though, is, and this is why I think the author of Judges has presented Benjamin last, or at least after Judah, I mean, is that this is the last word on Jerusalem in this part of the book. Is that, sure, Judah went up and fought against Jerusalem and even sacked it, but ultimately, it still ends up in Jebusites' hands. There are still Jebusites living in the area. And we know, of course, ultimately, that the city is rebuilt, right? I mean, that much should be obvious. And at whatever point that happens, the Jebusites are still there, and in fact are there even at the time that the author of Judges is writing the book.
That's not told us. It's not.
Right. That's all of the.
And that would make somebody who is critical of the Bible say, oh, here's your kind of issue, because it does not tell us. Fill in all the details.
Right.
So
that's when you tell people that they need to adjust their expectations.
Like you're given an opportunity to people for the reason of proving that that's what, you know, is preempting that,
right. So this strictly speaking doesn't have to do with the book of Judges, but when we're talking about the kind of strategy that we use in communicating with skeptics, one thing that we want to be careful of is not to try to submit the Bible to them, because sometimes their presuppositions and their questions are just way off base. And part of defending the Word of God to them is recognizing that the Word of God's not going to play by their rules, right? Like, so what if you expect all of the details to be filled in? Go complain to God about it. He chose not to. Deal with it. The remainder of this chapter shows us that Israel's failure is just progressively getting worse and worse. As we just point out, Jerusalem has been conquered, quote-unquote, but there are still Jebusites living there. Manasseh, Ephraim, and Zebulun all fail to drive out the inhabitants of their land so that the Canaanites continue to live among them, those forced laborers. All right, but then the text flips the order of things. I don't know if you picked up on this as we were reading through, but with Manasseh, Ephraim, Zebulun, we get all of these little notices. The Canaanites continued to live among them. But then once we get to Asher and Naphtali, they fail to drive out the inhabitants of the land, and now it's no longer the Canaanites who are living among the Israelites. It's the other way around. Asher and Naphtali are living among the Canaanites, which, again, gives you a sense of who's dominant in that relationship. It's not primarily Israelite with some Canaanite mixed in. It's primarily Canaanite with some Israelite mixed in. Ultimately, they end up being put to forced labor. But that's not always the case. In fact, things are so bad with Dan that they are confined to the hills because the Amorites will not allow them to come down to the plain. Right? They can't inhabit their territory hardly at all. We're going to see this becomes a bigger and bigger problem for the tribe of Dan until it kind of boils over. Right? We already know what's going to happen from the book of Joshua because Joshua just kind of offhandedly mentioned to us, oh yeah, this was before the tribe of Dan left their inheritance. We know ultimately that's where this is going. This situation here, where the Amorites have pressed Dan back into the hill country, is going to result ultimately in Dan abandoning their inheritance. Now, the curious thing here, there are a couple of tribes that are not mentioned. Issachar is not mentioned in this. The eastern tribes are not mentioned at all. But this is the beginning of a process that we call Canaanization. Rather than fully conquering the land as they were commanded, Israel allows the nations to live among them, to influence them. And this is going to happen exactly as the law predicted, and exactly as Joshua predicted. Israel has already been told multiple times that this is going to happen. In fact, they've been told this in confessional contexts, where there's a call and response, right? Where either Moses or Joshua says to Israel, all right, you know this is what's going to happen, right? And Israel says, yes. And Moses and Joshua say, all right, you know that if you allow this to happen, you're going to be cursed and driven out of the land, right? Israel says, yeah, yeah, we know that. And then they immediately turn around and let it happen. And things are going to play out, again, exactly the way as foretold. So that wraps us up for chapter 1. We will get into chapter 2 on Thursday. And I'm hoping to finish out this first section. So we'll do chapter 2 and, Lord willing, the first 6 verses of chapter 3. And we will see that some of the things that we've hinted at in chapter 1 today are just going to be stated explicitly. Things are going to get bad right out of the gate in the book of Judges. So thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments this morning.